This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. Survivors of Hurricane Katrina, who have already lived through the terrors of the storm and the nightmare of its aftermath, now must cope with a new reality, an unknown future in a strange place. Hundreds of thousands of people are scattering from the Gulf Coast to shelters all over the country. With a 250,000 evacuees already in Texas, Governor Rick Perry has warned that his state has reached its capacity. But more than 24 states, from as far south as Florida and as far west as California and Oregon, are gearing up to help. Tennessee reports it has already taken in 13,000 survivors. The Red Cross says it is operating 275 shelters in 9 states. But as officials work to provide for the immediate needs of shelter, food, and clothing, the long-range future of evacuees is unclear. But one reality is slowly taking shape. Whether temporary or permanent, the United States is living through one of the largest, if not the largest, and fastest diasporas in its history. And the personal and cultural ramifications of this massive movement will be felt for years. We want to hear from those of you who have lived through the aftermath of Katrina. If you've been displaced by the storm, share your story. If you're helping take in evacuees from the Gulf Coast, we want to hear from you as well. Our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address, totn@npr.org. We're joined now by LA Times reporter Tony Perry, who's covering the evacuation story in Houston, Texas. Thanks for being with us, Tony.
My pleasure.
Now, Texas, as the governor says, is at its capacity. What does that mean? Are people now being turned away? What's the scene there in Houston today?
Well, Governor Rick Perry yesterday said that he was organizing an airlift from the Dallas and San Antonio area for newly arriving evacuees who are arriving on buses, going to put them on, check them out first medically, and then put them on planes out of state where they can receive better services. The freeway signs here in Houston, which just a couple of days ago said, call this number for shelter and assistance, now say, shelters full, proceed to Fort Chaffee, Arkansas. So clearly, even Houston, which is a city of 3.4 million, even Houston is straining to accommodate tens of thousands of people arriving in a large sort of wave and needing more than just their numbers, needing a lot of services and a lot of help. Some people are arriving without 2 cents to their name and with virtually no wearable clothing beyond a day or two, and with great medical needs, and of course with children who are going to need to be educated. This is going to strain Texas, and it's going to challenge Texas in a way. Even the Texans, who like to brag that they can do almost anything bigger and better than anybody else, it's going to strain them a good deal.
Yeah, and does anybody have any sense of how long a state like Texas and other states that are taking in evacuees are going to be responsible for educating children, for providing shelters? Anybody even know at this point how long this is going to go on for?
No. Among the many things that we're learning is how well a city and a state and a nation can provide for people over a long term. Now, here in Houston, where the Astrodome and several other public buildings are being used, the program is to get people up and out of those shelters and into more permanent housing, apartments, homes, condos, whatever, get them out just as quickly as possible, because a long-term refugee camp-esque existence isn't in anybody's best interest, not the cities and not the people themselves. So in the next couple of days, from what we're being told, the Housing Authority is going to make a big push to get rental units available. The Black Ministers Coalition has done the same and preached from their pulpits on Sunday, open your homes to our evacuee neighbors from Louisiana. So all the resources that are possible, public and private, are being employed here. Education, the buses will start rolling up to the Astrodome tomorrow and taking children to schools. They're going to reopen 2 schools that have been closed for declining enrollment. Now they're going to be reopened for the children from Katrina. Someone was joking that they really ought to be called Katrina Elementary School 1 and 2.
Mm-hmm.
The Texas Unemployment Office, by the way, which does about 500,000 claims a month, will have to do 1 million claims in about the next 5 days from people from Louisiana and Mississippi.
This is really staggering, isn't it?
The numbers are just staggering, and it continues, that even though the governor had said, no mas, in Texas, the buses keep arriving because there really aren't good communications with Louisiana. And so the buses roll up just this morning to the Astrodome. Nurses and doctors go on, check the folks out. If they have critical medical needs, they pull them off the bus and say, we'll treat you here. We're not going to make you, you know, go somewhere else. But if they're not critical, they're being sent elsewhere. Texas is treading water. Houston has had some experience with this. Houston is in the hurricane belt, so they know what it's like to have one of these storms. Nothing like Katrina, of course, but they had Allison 4 years ago, a tropical storm that flooded 55,000 homes here, and they developed an emergency plan after that. What they never figured on, what nobody figured on, was that Houston would become the center point of an evacuation effort for a four-state area.
And the other thing is, these are people who have been through an unimaginably traumatic experience, apart from the fact that they've lost everything. Some people are separated from members of their family. They've just been through an almost unimaginable experience. I mean, they're traumatized.
We're dealing with broken families here that got separated during the storm or during the evacuation effort or during the hell that was the Superdome and the New Orleans Convention Center experience. And now reuniting families is a major task. Red Cross has a website that people can plug into. They've got terminals at the Astrodome helping evacuees to plug in their information so that they can find relatives or be found by relatives. Other people are walking around, many of them in a kind of dazed attitude, with sandwich board-style signs saying, if you hear from, and then there'll be a list of names, please tell me. It's the sort of thing we saw after 9/11, frankly, in Lower Manhattan. People had those flyers that they posted on every vertical surface. If you know Joe Smith, he was working on the X floor of the World Trade Center, call me. Well, it's the same phenomena, just much larger here and much more, great deal more pathos, because in that situation, the 9/11, I think we knew within a few days whether people were survivors or not. Here it could take weeks, if not months, to know fully who lived and who died from Katrina.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Tony.
My pleasure.
LA Times reporter Tony Perry joined us by phone from his hotel in Houston, Texas. And we're going to take calls now. If you'd like to join our discussion, the number is 1-800-989-8255. And we're joined now by Yvonne, and she's calling from Tennessee. Hi, Yvonne. Yvonne, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Yvonne. Go ahead.
We lived in Bay St. Louis and the Hancock County line, and we've got a shrimp boat. My husband's been a commercial fisherman his whole life, and we took the boat up the Pearl River where the eye came through, and we were going to go up to the shelter. By the time that we got going and, you know, got up there, that it was, you know, a little late for that. So after the boat was all secured and everything, there was lots up there that went up there for shelter, and you know, all of a sudden, you know, everything started just coming down. The wind was blowing so hard that it almost didn't even look like it was raining, because it was just going sideways.
Now, how many people were on this boat with you?
There was four of us and one dog, one small dog. She's 16 years old. And so we all just, you know, hunkered down the best we could. You know, we had two bunks in there with mattresses in case, you know, any of the windows blew out or anything. But thank God the boat saved us. It was actually one of the safer places we could have been without being in a shelter.
That seems amazing to me, that a boat would have been one of the safest places to be. How could that be?
Well, that's the strange thing. The boat is very well built. It's a large boat. It's, you know, 50 by 20. There's rigging on the boat, you know, which actually strengthens it. And thank God we had just glass, so that gave some extra strength. The main concern was falling trees, and one fell on each side of the boat. The outriggers, which we put down to shrimp with, were up. And these trees just fell, and then those outriggers just guided them down into the water rather than on us.
How long did this go on? How long were you on the boat, and how did it finally end? Where did you land?
We just got off the boat today.
Oh, wow.
And are heading, like I said, we're heading up north to some family. We lost everything. We did get a chance to drive back partway and walk through about 8 to 12 inches of mud and to see the house. Part of it's still standing. My husband climbed up and kind of looked inside, and it kind of just really looked like someone had put a gallon of mud in a cup of water in a blender and let it go. I mean, everything is upside down. There's no ceilings. There's no nothing.
So you've just been living in your boat, and you got off the boat and went in and checked on your house, and then you've been.
Yeah, we've just been staying on the boat. Things are so bad around there, as far as seeing things. So military helicopters go by constantly, and that hard drumming. And it's just about. It kind of just drives you crazy, Your nerves are on parade anyway.
Yeah. And now you said, I just want to finish your story. We're going to have to take a break soon, but you are with family and you're safe, it sounds like. Is that right?
Yeah, we're safe. Like I say, we're on our way to Green Bay and, going to stay with family for a little while so we can come back and see what needs to be done with the house. I mean, it's totaled.
So you are hoping to return?
We have to do something with the house because the freezer's, upended. There's, rotting food all over, in the house. And, the whole neighborhood is like that.
Right. Well, Yvonne, I'm glad to hear that you're safe. And I wish you the best of luck in the future when you return or wherever you finally do land. Thanks so much for calling us.
Okay. Thank you.
This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Neil Conan is away. Evacuees from the areas devastated by Hurricane Katrina continue to spread out into the country. Planes of evacuees from Hurricane Katrina started to arrive in Charlotte, North Carolina today, the latest of more than a dozen states to take in refugees. We're talking about the needs of the evacuees as they try to create a temporary life in a new city. Some will undoubtedly decide to remain in their adopted homes. Others will eventually have to make their way back to whatever remains. If you're part of this story, we'd love to hear from you. If you're taking in evacuees or providing aid to those in need, and of course, if you've been displaced, give us a call with your story. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. And while a large number of evacuees have gone to live with family in the southeast, many may find themselves on much longer journeys. Joe Thornton is the Deputy Secretary for Military Affairs and Public Safety for the state of West Virginia. He joins us by phone from Camp Dawson Army Training Center in Kingwood, West Virginia. Thanks for taking the time to be with us, Mr. Thornton.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Now, I understand evacuees began arriving there yesterday morning. How many are there now? How many are you expecting to arrive there?
They started arriving yesterday morning about 6 a.m. In about three waves throughout the day. We currently have about 200 here right now, and we're certainly expecting to take a few more. We have the plan in place to accept around 480. Our resource would be a bit stretched here, but the governor said make this happen, and we are determined to make this happen.
All right. What kind of accommodations are you able to provide for these people?
Oh, this is a wonderful place. It was a well-thought-out plan. The governor said, we want to show the nation what a caring state we are, and that's what we're trying to do. So we put a plan in place to kind of give them a sort of an inclusive community, if you will. And this camp serves a perfect purpose for that all the amenities that they would need for rest, relaxation, recuperation, recovery are all right here.
And how does it seem to be going so far? How are the people reacting to their new situation there?
Most receptive is the best way to put it. They are so grateful for what is going on. I think if you compare what they've been through over the last week and a half that they would enjoy to be anywhere, but this is a beautiful setting, and I just continue to hear how grateful they are.
Yeah. What about medical needs? A lot of the people that we have seen pictures of and seen on television screen, there have been a lot of very sick people, people really traumatized by what's happened to them. How are you dealing with all that?
I think overall they're dealing very well with it. We've had some medical situations, nothing terribly bad or horrible, if you will, but for the most part, I think they're just tired, and they're just happy to be somewhere where they can finally just decompress a little.
Does anybody know, I mean, is it too soon in that situation for people to be thinking about whether this is where they're going to settle in West Virginia, or that you need to find more permanent housing? This isn't going to be, this is really temporary shelter, correct?
It is. We have a plan in place to keep them here as long as necessary, but of course, reunification is first and foremost, and we've already had some of that happen, and that's the wonderful part of this. We are of the next phase, if you will, of this is to try to place them in other settings that are a little bit more permanent, because many of them, as you said, aren't going to be able to return to New Orleans, and that's all they have. That's the only place their family was. So some of them are looking. I have heard them tell me that they plan on staying in West Virginia if they can. Some say they're going to go back and visit in New Orleans eventually, and some say that that's their life, and they're going back. So I've heard mixed on that.
Yeah. Now, you said when you say reunification, are you talking about families being reunified, and have you already seen that happen?
Yes. We have it set up here. Verizon came in and set up free phone banks, and we have internet service, and they have access to all of that. They come in, they sit down, they've made phone calls if they have family elsewhere. And we had one just about an hour and a half ago. The family drove in from Washington, D.C., hadn't heard from their mom until she got here, and that was a touching scene.
Oh, that's great. So you've had that happen already.
Yes, we have.
Yeah. Who is this being run by? Is it civilian volunteers? I mean, what?
That's the great thing about this. When the governor said, we want to do this, Secretary Spears put this plan into action in less than 24 hours, and we got all the key players at the table, the Department of Military Affairs and Public Safety, the Department of Health and Human Resources, Red Cross, and around that table, not one person said we can't, we shouldn't, or we won't. Everybody said we'll do it, let's do it, we're going to make it happen.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful operation. I've never seen anything like it.
And again, how long do you think you can keep this up for? Any sense of that?
We're going to do it as long as we can.
Yeah.
Everybody is running on fumes, but, you know, the real story are the evacuees. You know, we're all tired, but when you think what they've been through, it doesn't compare.
Well, Joe, thanks so much for being with us.
Glad to be here. Thank you very much.
Joe Thornton is the Deputy Secretary for Military Affairs and Public Safety for West Virginia, and he joined us by phone from Camp Dawson Army Training Center in Kingwood, West Virginia. A lot of people are also finding shelter with their own families. Linda Hoskins lives with her family in Mountain Brook, Alabama. That's a suburb of Birmingham. But last night, they were joined by her sister's family. Lisa Hoskins is on the phone with us now from her home. Thanks for being with us, Lisa.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So tell me now, your household has doubled in size, is that right?
Yes, it has. We're glad to have my sister, her husband, and their two children. We're grateful to have them, and we're grateful they're safe and alive, and I'm grateful I didn't live in New Orleans anymore so I could give them shelter.
Now, how did you make contact with them? How did they make their way to your house? How did this all come about?
Well, we had a lot of trouble reaching each other, actually, by cell phone. They evacuated to Dallas, and we talked whenever we could. We tried repeatedly and spoke maybe a couple of times a day, and we knew fairly early on that nobody was going back in. After the levee breached, we knew that pretty much everything would be gone. And we made the decision then that we would welcome them into our home indefinitely.
Yeah. Yeah, they can't go. They don't know when they can go back, in other words.
They don't. Nobody's being allowed back in except one member of the household can go back in just to assess damage or pick up a few things if there are any things to pick up. And they have to leave that same day.
Yeah.
So they're not allowed back in.
Now, this is a temporary situation that could go on for a while, and there's a lot of long-term long-term needs here. Let's talk first about, for instance, I think it's nephews. You have nephews?
I have a niece and a nephew.
A niece and a nephew? Are they going to go to school locally?
That is phenomenal, very supportive. The outpouring is amazing, and the school is welcoming my niece to kindergarten tomorrow with welcome all, open arms, welcoming her. She's already had children bring gifts to her. Parents have donated clothing to her already, Target gift cards, and sweet notes written from classmates. And she is feeling pretty excited about it, actually.
Yeah. Oh, what about finances? Obviously, your sister and her husband are not able to work right now.
No. My husband, I mean, my brother-in-law owns, with his brother, a business in New Orleans that's basically tourist-driven. And so basically they don't have a business right now. So financially they have nothing. And we are just so grateful that we're able to help them.
Yeah. It's going to be difficult, though. And what about all of you living together? Is the space big enough? How big is your house for?
Well, interestingly enough, I had a smaller house until spring, and we moved to a much larger home. And I find it wonderful that God provided us a bigger home so that now we could invite them and they could be comfortable and they can have the whole downstairs of the home as their home.
That's great. And your brother-in-law is going back to try and assess the damage in New Orleans,
yeah,
is that right?
Yeah, he's assess the damage, see what they have left. They're not really letting people stay, so he's just taking a short trip to assess his home, and if they have possessions left, you know, to take what he can and then get out again and come back.
Yeah.
Because it's not health, you know, it's not safe and also not legal,
right,
to stay. So we're planning on having them as long as they would like to be here, because we actually find it quite nice to be together.
Oh, that's good. That's great.
We're very close family. I have a very large family in New Orleans, many aunts, uncles, cousins, and I'm so very grateful that not one of them lost their lives.
Do you think you'll be taking more family members in then?
It's a possibility. I have an aunt and uncle who are at a hospital in Birmingham right now. They were at Baptist Hospital in New Orleans. My uncle has Parkinson's and cancer, and they had to be airlifted off the roof of the building after many days of horrific conditions in Baptist Hospital. Staff did their very best, but they had no medical supplies. They were having to euthanize people's pets, but because they allowed the workers to bring their families and pets with them for the evacuation, and it was just a horrific experience.
Yeah.
And my uncle just had to sit in a wheelchair, slumped over for days, with nowhere to lie down, and just miraculously, they were airlifted to my city. And I'm so very grateful, because I'm the only relative of all the family who lives out of town. So,
oh wow,
really a blessing that they're not more than 3 miles from my home at Brookwood Hospital, and I'm able to care for them and help them through this at the same time.
Well, that's great. And you know, you're very lucky you're a close family. I hope you all keep getting along as well as you are right now.
Oh, I know that we will. We're very close, and I just am so grateful that I could hug my sister in person, and I'm going to cry.
Okay. Well, don't do that.
Hugging her just felt like the best thing in the world.
I was great.
So worried, and I'm just...
I can imagine how worried you were watching this all go unfold before you on television.
It's unbelievable to watch your city just go under, and New Orleans is a very unique city, and people who are from there, well, we're pretty passionate about our city, and it's just such a loss, the city itself and the people.
So you feel that loss even from there in Alabama?
Very much
even
so.
Even though you have your family close to you now, you still feel that loss of that?
Very much so. It's New Orleans will always be a part of me, and I'm a part of it, and, you know, you can't get away from that. And I know the people of New Orleans, and one day they'll rebuild it, and it'll be back to its original greatness. But it's going to be a very, very long, drawn-out process, and my heart reaches out to all those who are there still, and I just thank all the workers and all the people who donate money, and I just can't believe the goodness of people in my community who are reaching out just to me, who I'm not even from here originally, and the outpouring has been just tremendous.
Well, Lisa, thanks so much for talking with us, and good luck to you and your whole family.
Thank
Glad
you
they're
so
safe.
Much.
Okay. Lisa Hoskins joined us by phone from her home in Mountain Brook, Alabama. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We are talking about the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, about the evacuation and the diaspora of people from that region of the country to states all over, from east to west, north and south. If you'd like to join our discussion, the number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK, and we're going to take a call now from Kitty in Tucson, Arizona. Hi, Kitty.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
I'm just calling. I'm actually on my way to Phoenix to stay with my brothers. I was displaced. My story isn't as bad as everyone else's, but undergraduate student at LSU, and the situation there is just very overwhelming because of what has happened to New Orleans. School was out for us all of last week. We're supposed to be continuing Tuesday. I don't really know if that's going to happen either. Basically, Baton Rouge has doubled in size within the matter of one day, and just kind of like, wow, all of these people coming in, and I don't even know if we have any more room for them. The PMAC, which is the Pete Maravich Center, our basketball court, has turned into a trauma center, a trauma hospital, and busloads of people coming in with, you know, lacerations from the Superdome, and have you seen my husband in 6 days? You know, I haven't seen him. Do you have any food? I haven't eaten in 2 days, and it's absolutely, you know, Baton Rouge, you know, the hurricane didn't really hit it very hard. Where I was staying, it wasn't too bad. We lost power for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of trees down.
And Kitty, what are you going to do about school? Are you going to transfer?
My parents, I'm from Florida, actually, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, and I went to LSU from there. And so they felt, you know, watching everything on TV with all the looting and everything, they felt it really wasn't safe for me to stay. We got an email from the chancellor saying that there was civil unrest in downtown Baton Rouge, and so they just felt, you know, it's not safe for me to be there. Either you need to come home here, or, you know, I have my brothers in Phoenix, so I'm just going to transfer to ASU, hopefully, for the semester, and pray that next semester, next spring, it will somehow be back to normal, but I really don't. It's looking pretty doubtful.
Yeah.
You know, it's a quaint college town, and there's no gas, really. I had to go to 4 gas stations before I could get any gas to come here, and it's just so crowded, and it's very sad.
Yeah.
So many of my friends from New Orleans area, too, and they, you know, their parents lost their jobs, homes. It's everything terrible. And even LSU, I don't even know. I mean, so many students are actually trying to go to LSU, and, you know, we don't have enough teachers. So it's like, you know, you go to the website, and instructors needed. We need people, please, you know. I mean, I have my neighbor, who is actually a graduate student teaching English, and he says, you know, his small classes of 20 to 30 are going to be up to like 50 or 60 people, and he's going to be teaching 5 of them, and it's just, it's very overwhelming.
Yeah.
And I want to send out all my prayers and hope that, you know, someday it will get back to normal, and hopefully the city can hopefully get back to normal, but it's just a little hard, you know, having to leave, you know, your college, all your friends behind.
What year are you in? I mean, what year are you in school?
This would be my second year.
Your second year. So just starting your sophomore year. Well, Kitty, I hope that it all works out, and I hope that eventually you do get an opportunity to return to LSU,
I know,
whenever that might be.
Right. If football game, which everybody's freaking out about the football season. You know, I don't know how that's going to be either, but hopefully it'll all get back to normal soon.
Hopefully it will. Thank you so much for calling us.
Thank you.
This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary. We're discussing the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina today. We're talking with as many people as possible about the experiences they have had, people who have been evacuated, people who are trying to recover from the storm, people who are helping those who have been through this terrible hurricane. And if you'd like to join the discussion, the number is 1-800-989-8255. We're going to take a call now from Jack, and he is in Dallas, Texas. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Lynn. I'm an Army pathologist. We're assisting the state of Texas currently. I'm TDY. And the greater temporary duty orders in temporary the greatest Dallas area. But I must admit I'm really depressed at this point because we're dealing with a lot of people who very clearly bodies are from lower socioeconomic part of the plateau, the human pyramid. Many of them are edentulous. They haven't seen apparently dentists for decades. I'm afraid there are going to be an enormous number of bodies which will be literally buried in unnamed graves.
I'm sorry, have you started the process already, Jack? I mean,
yes, we have. We're getting a steady stream of corpses through, and, you know, the common databases one would use many times are frustrated by the experiences the bodies have undergone. For instance, many of them have been in very warm water for a long time, and then the transport over has, in many instances, made post-mortem fingerprinting even useless. And then, of course, unless they people, for whatever reason, have been in some federal database, you know, there's going to be little use of attempting that.
I was going to ask you if you're going to be able to use the information that you're gathering there to help people find their missing loved ones.
You know, we have an idea, but again, without going into detail, which might be disturbing to listeners, the shapes of the bodies we're getting almost defy a description of someone who might say, well, my 75-year-old grandmother, whatever. You know, we could go with gender, but beyond that, trust me, the task that's facing all of us who are engaged in this effort right now is monumental, and certainly the states and the federal government are utilizing all of the resources they have available to them.
But, you know, Jack, this brings to my mind the fact that from everything we're hearing today on our show and all the other news coverage, just so many different aspects of this storm keep occurring, and one hasn't really thought about what you're discussing, perhaps. We've been thinking about saving people and getting them shelter, but this is one of the grimmest, I think, tasks probably out there.
You know, and unfortunately, it can be a very important one. You know, there are states which obviously need this information for wills, whatever. You know, I'm not a lawyer, I'm a pathologist, so I only wanted to touch on those points. I had heard earlier in one of the newscasts that, you know, body identifications were proceeding in a normal order, and, well, I would like to just say that they're certainly proceeding, but unlike a battlefield to which we would be more familiar of bodies from, this is many orders of magnitude more difficult. And again, pulling a DNA sample, well, okay, you know, you're talking about a process that's very expensive, takes weeks of time, and, you know, you have to have other people who have already contributed into it to have any database to compare it against.
Yeah. Well, Jack, I thank you for sharing this aspect of the story.
I'm sorry, that's such a grim one.
It is a difficult one. It's a difficult one to talk about. And thanks for making us aware.
Keep it going.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Among the parishes and counties hit hard by the hurricane, several Indian reservations along the Gulf Coast also bore the storm's brunt. Brenda Dardar-Robichaud is a principal chief of United Homa Nation, and she joins us by phone from her home in Raceland, Louisiana. Thanks for being with us, Brenda.
Thank you for having me.
How badly was the Homa Nation affected by this?
A lot of our Indian settlements were just totally devastated by this storm, this hurricane. We have, let me give you a little brief background, probably it'll be great to start. Our people live along the eastern coast of South Louisiana, the southeastern coast of Louisiana. And we live all along the bayous, and the Terrebonne Parish, Lafourche Parish, is our largest populated area. But we also reside in the New Orleans area, where Louis Armstrong Park is, was once our ceremonial grounds. There's a plaque commemorating that very fact, and we played our traditional game of stickball in that area as well. And we migrated south along the bayous, but some of our tribal members went back and formed settlements in the different parishes that were devastated by this hurricane in order to be able to go to school. If you lived in the parishes that I mentioned earlier, Lafourche and Terrebonne, educational opportunities were not available to you. But in the New Orleans area, it was. So a lot of our tribal members moved back to New Orleans back in the 30s and 40s so that their children could attend school and receive an education. And so those settlements were just totally destroyed, as was everyone else with this hurricane.
You know, one thing we've been talking about this hour is the fact that this evacuation is something of a diaspora, is a word we've been using, and that is that people are just getting scattered everywhere. Are you concerned that this is going to permanently scatter your people, splinter the Homa Nation?
This is a major concern of ours, and so that's why we as tribal leaders are going to have to address this, because this hurricane just totally destroyed, as I said, New Orleans and our communities. But we've had this happen in some of our other tribal communities in Lafourche and Terrebonne Parish. And every time our communities are hit by these hurricanes, we have people who just come back. We have strong ties to our land. It's not just a piece of property for us. It's our way of life. It's our history. It's our heritage. And we have strong ties. So a lot of our tribal members come back and rebuild, knowing that they might be in harm's way again. But we do have some who choose not to come back. You know, they just move and relocate and start a new life, if you will. And that's our concern, is that that may happen in this area. And so we as tribal members and tribal leaders are going to have to address the needs of our tribal members in those settlements of around New Orleans and make sure that we can help them rebuild and make sure that we can meet their needs, that they will come back. Because it's our concern that if they don't, then we're losing a part of our history, we're losing a part of who we are.
Yeah. And do members of the nation qualify for any type of special federal aid that will help them recover?
Unfortunately not. We are a state-recognized tribe. We've had that status since 1979, and we've been in the federal recognition process since 1984. And this process has just dragged on and on. So at the present moment, we do not qualify for any of the federal assistance that might be given otherwise.
Well, thanks so much for your time today, Brenda.
Thank you.
Brenda Dardar-Robichaud is principal chief for United Homa Nation. She joined us from her home in Raceland, Louisiana. And let's see if we can take one more call. Greg in Houston, Texas. Hi, Greg. Greg, go ahead.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, the main thing that I really wanted to call in is that it seems like y'all have a good communication and in touch with people in Louisiana. There's still a large need of rescue workers with their boats to get in touch with the wildlife and fisheries. I don't feel a need of fear, because there's such a large barrier of military workers and West Baton Rouge and everybody keeping us safe. I was there yesterday in the area when the altercation happened with the lawless factor there, and I felt completely safe, even though the shots were fired right below the truck there on the bridge.
You were on the bridge, and you were part of the group that was fired upon, is that what you're saying?
Yes, ma'am.
Can you tell us a little bit about what happened? Because we've heard a lot about that, but I haven't heard from anyone that was actually part of that.
Well, of course, we were in the convoy of workers going in there to rescue the people out. And as we was going in, we reached the last checkpoint with the military, and we were told to group together, bumper to bumper, and stay in the vehicles. And I was with a group from Opelousas, Louisiana. I am from Louisiana originally. And as the shots were, as we was told that, there became two shots below our vehicle. And right away, David and Frank, the Opelousas police officers, engaged with these people.
And so you're saying that as rescue workers, you felt safe. You felt that there is law and there is order there, and you were taken care of.
Oh, completely, yes. Matter of fact, helicopters, three of them were in the air above us, including an Apache helicopter.
Okay.
And I feel that a lot of people will be afraid to volunteer because they feel like they're not safe, but that's not the case.
That's not the case. And are you leaving there now? Is that what you said? Or you were there for, a couple of days trying to...
I was there almost 2 days. I own my own 18-wheeler, and I was happened to be in Lafayette. My load in Houston did not unload till tomorrow, so I took the time to go do that.
And so what were your experiences? Were you able to rescue people and take them out?
Yes, 18 individuals were rescued. I can't say enough about the West Baton Rouge police officers. There's so much going on heroic that we'll never hear about.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your call, Greg.
Yes. Y'all keep in prayer, and please ask for more volunteers.
We will. We'll do everything that we can.
Thank you, ma'am.
All right. I just want to remind our listeners that this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.